All right, guys, you are locked on Falcons. I'm your host, Aaron Freeman, and today I am taking another look at the Falcons' Week 15 win over the Arizona Cardinals. We'll also be talking about the impact of the season-ending injury to running back Ito Smith.
You are Locked On Falcons, your daily Atlanta Falcons podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
All right, guys, you know me. I'm Aaron Freeman, been covering the Falcons for many years at FalFans.com, on Twitter at FalFans, and of course, I host this illustrious Locked On Falcons podcast. Today, we're going to talk a little bit deeper about the Falcons' win over the Cardinals, at least giving you some of my observations that I did not do on yesterday's Rapid Reaction podcast, where I seemingly got lost in the weeds talking about explosiveness and turnovers and all these sorts of things, sort of these big picture issues that were prevalent in the game. But today we're going to focus a little bit more on some of the individual players that stood out and maybe some of my observations at some notable positions where we're still sort of trying to evaluate things and figure out things before the end of the season. But before we jump into that, let's talk about Ito Smith, who suffered a knee injury in this Cardinals game, re-aggravating a knee injury that he was dealing with in the week prior. He's going to have season-ending surgery. It's not anything like an ACL or anything serious like that, but it's certainly enough that it's going to knock him out for more than 2 weeks. And so the Falcons basically cleared out a roster spot, put him on IR, let him have that surgery, and get him ready for 2019. One of the things that we talked quite a bit during the summer in August and in July as well, and a little bit in June, I think, too, about the summer of Ito. It never really came to fruition, but Ito wraps up a pretty solid rookie season, certainly outperformed any of my expectations. One of the things I noted throughout the summer after the Falcons drafted was, Ito's not going to do much during the regular season unless there's injuries and whatnot. And so that was a big reason why I thought he would have basically a big summer and get a lot of opportunities to shine in the summer, because that would be really the last opportunity, if all things went according to plan, that the Falcons would be able to really get a long look-see at him. And of course, things did not go according to plan. Devontae Freeman got injured. But, you look at Ito Smith's 2018 rookie season, in 14 games, or I think in 13 games technically, because I don't think he played in a season opener. He finished his rookie season with 90 carries for 315 yards, averaging 3.5 yards per carry, 4 touchdowns, added 27 catches for 152 yards, a total of 467 yards from scrimmage. And you could look at some of those numbers and compare it pretty favorably with what Devontae Freeman did in his rookie season, where he had 65 carries for 248 yards, which was a 3.8 yards per carry, 1 touchdown, 30 catches, 225 yards, and another receiving touchdown. So he finished his season with 473 yards from scrimmage. So similar numbers. Ito got probably, arguably, a little bit more playing time than Devontae did. Got a significantly more touches, or maybe like 20 more touches. And so the fact that he was able to finish with a lower yards from scrimmage isn't necessarily conducive to him, being that sort of explosive guy that Devontae showcased a couple of times as a rookie. But we know Ito has that ability in him. So it's a pretty solid rookie season, certainly outperformed. If you had asked me during the summer, I'm pretty sure I probably said this on a podcast, was like, the over or under on how many touches Ito gets as a rookie, I would have said, set it at 50 and take the under. And so the fact that he basically more than doubled that, is a testament to me being wrong, but also a testament to sort of how things went awry. That 3.5 yards per carry is going to probably stand out to a lot of folks. And regular listeners of this podcast know that I'm not a big fan of yards per carry as far as a measure of running back efficiency. I'll touch upon that exactly why in a moment. But I prefer success rate, which measures basically, it's more, in a nutshell, it's basically looking at running backs' yards on a sort of a pass-fail rate based off of down and distance. So if you getting 8 yards on a draw play on a 3rd and 15 is not better than getting 2 yards on a third down, on a third and one or something like that. But according to yards per carry, it is. So you look at Ito Smith's success rate this season, it was 46.7% this year. As I've said a number of times, if you're a regular listener, when you look at success rate, you want a number above 45%. 50% is great. Anything above 50% is excellent. 45% is good. Above 40% is solid. Anything below 40% is, you know, underwhelming. Below 35% is poor. 46.7% is pretty good. So, you know, you look at that yards per carry number and think, oh, he's whatever, based off of what your evaluation of that. He had an underwhelming rookie season or whatever, but that 46%, that 47% is pretty good, particularly when you compare it to a guy like Tevin Coleman, whose success rate so far this season has been 42%, 42.3, which is, you know, solid, but nothing spectacular. But you look at Coleman's yards per carry and it's 4.7, and you look at literally his yards per carry jumped like 0.7 yards just from yesterday's game, where he averaged 11 point something yards on 11 runs, 145 yards or whatever. And like basically because of three of those runs where he got over like 130 yards, his yards per carry almost jumped like a full yard, you know, by I think 0.08. If you took away those three runs, his yards per carry would drop from like 4.7, like 3.8, I think. So that's what I mean when I say yards per carry gets skewed by long runs. It's not a real good indicator of running back efficiency. You know, 2% of Coleman's total carries this season accounted for 20% of his yards, if you just look at those three big runs he had yesterday against the Cardinals. So, you know, going back to Ito Smith, what we'll see, my expectation is what we'll see from the Falcons is that they'll plug in Brian Hill as the number two running back over these next 2 weeks. I think we won't see sort of the split that we've seen with Ito and Coleman for most of this season. You'll probably see Coleman get the bulk of those carries. I'll be curious to see if the Falcons elevate Jeremy Langford, who they picked up on the practice squad earlier this month at the running back position, to the active roster, or if they activate somebody else from the practice squad or sign a player from elsewhere on the roster, just because, you know, at this point in the season, you probably have a couple of nagging injuries here or there, and you may want to shore up some depth potentially for guys that may not be able fully healthy for this weekend's game against Carolina. One player that we can be safely assume is not going to be on the roster to replace Ito Smith is Devontae Freeman. Dan Quinn indicated today that he does not expect Devontae to play in these last two games. He hasn't been practicing yet. He sounded a little optimistic, you know, last week and the week before, but, you know, that's just classic Dan Quinn when you ask him a question like that and he's going to sound optimistic until he's not. But, you know, that's all I have to say about the Ito Smith thing. We'll talk a little bit more in depth about some of my observations looking at the offensive line performances and the defense performances in just a bit coming up on today's podcast. But I do want to plug the Locked On NFL Draft podcast. It is everybody's favorite daily national NFL podcast. You can check out a great lineup of guests joining host Matt Williamson every single day, each and every week. On Mondays, you get various experts from around the Locked On Podcast Network giving you insights into the biggest stories of the week. Tuesdays, you can check out former NFL quarterback Sage Rosenfels. Wednesdays, you have Pro Football Focus's Mike Renner. Thursdays, ESPN's Mike Sando joins Matt on the show. And of course, Friday, you can check out Matt's Picks of the Week. That's the Locked On NFL Podcast. Find that wherever you get your Locked On podcasts. Your team every day. So let's talk about the Falcons' offensive line performances. In particular, rewatching the game and sort of these last couple of weeks since the Falcons have sort of shuffled their offensive line, sort of keeping a close eye on particularly that right side of the offensive line where they've had new faces like Zane Beatles and Ty Sambrello, just because we kind of at this point know what Jake Matthews and Wes Schweitzer and Alex Mack are at this point. And, you know, it's really Beatles and Sambrello and Garland and whatnot to really look, dial in on to sort of see what they can bring to the table and potentially fighting for opportunities to come back next year and sort of what roles that they can potentially carve next year. What was notable to me was that the Falcons did rotate Zane Beadles and Ben Garland at that right guard spot. Beadles wound up with the bulk of the snaps, but I think Garland wound up playing about 30 snaps overall in the game. He got a couple late in the game at center on like that one last series, but that only resulted in maybe like 3 or 4 snaps or something like that. I think it was 3 snaps because they had a 3 and out because they were running out of the clock with 3 consecutive Brian Hill runs. So I thought watching the game, it, to me, was notable, particularly early in the game, Beadles' struggles. He missed a number of blocks, seemed a little bit erratic. I'm curious to know if there was an injury that I'm forgetting that he was dealing with during the week, or if there was something going on with him. But, you know, I thought Garland had the better performance. I thought, you know, both of those guys in terms of, I think the first touchdown run that Coleman had, Garland had a key block on the second level. Then there was another big run. I can't remember which one it was, for whether it was the touchdown that was called back or the other touchdown that, or the not the first touchdown run, the first big run that he had, the 65 yarder that he got tackled at like the 5, Garland had a key block on. And then I think it was one of the touchdown runs later on. I can't remember if it was the one that was called back or the one that actually scored. Beadles, I think it was the one that he actually scored on. Beadles had a good key block on the second level. That's what both of those guys do well. And that's been a big reason why I think the Falcons running game has been, at least when you look at success rate has and yards per carry, has been a lot better in the second half of the season than it was when Brandon Fusco was the starting right guard. Just because of those guys' ability to sort of hit those second level blocks, which is the biggest weakness of Fusco's game. I think it would be interesting to see if the Falcons continue this rotation with Beadles and Garland. I think based off of this performance and in my opinion, based off of previous games, Garland is the better option, but I know Garland isn't an ideal option at that spot, which is why I think the Falcons went with Beadles. We saw that in that Saints game where he really struggled against Sheldon Rankins, but that's really neither here nor there. It was only a matter of time before Sheldon Rankins started becoming a Falcon killer. You know, I basically predicted that the day the Saints drafted him, because he was one of those guys that I really wanted the Falcons to draft that year. And if they had, we wouldn't be talking about drafting Ed Oliver and Quinnen Williams. We'd be talking about, man, we got one of the best young duos of deep tackles in the entire league with Grady Jarrett and Sheldon Rankins. But that's a conversation for another day. So I'll be curious to sort of see if the Falcons continue to rotate those guys or if Garland has won the job back. We'll see. I thought it was interesting to look at Ty Sambrello, and you guys know, if you've been a regular listener to this podcast, you can follow me on Twitter, you know I'm not a huge fan of Ty Sambrello. Most people think Mohamed Sanu is that player I quote-unquote hate the most on the Falcons, but if the least favorite player on the team is Ty Sambrello, I wouldn't say I hate him. I don't hate anybody that I don't know. There's a couple of people I can think of that I'm not huge, huge fans of, but I would say I thought Ty Sambrello played reasonably well. I thought he played much better against Marcus Golden than I thought he was going to play. That first sack that Golden got wasn't really his fault because he thought Austin Hooper was going to chip because Austin Hooper was outside of him. And he thought when Golden tried to attack his edge, Hooper would stay outside and chip. And Hooper didn't do that. And so then Golden just went right around Ty Sambrello for an easy sack. You know, the thing about Ty Sambrello is this, and this has been something that's been pretty clear to me over the years, is he's very effective blocking in space. When you can pull him, when you can get him on the second level, he's very effective. When it comes to sort of strength and power to move a guy off the ball, that's not really what he does well. So if you can get him out on the move, he's effective. And it was noticeable to me that the Falcons, a lot of their runs in this game against Arizona were to the left side. I think only 6 of the combined 20 runs for Coleman and Ito in this game were charted to go to the right side of the offensive line. They were fairly one-dimensional running behind their strength with between Jake Matthews and Wes Schweitzer and Alex Mack to that left side rather than running to the right side where they have question marks. I wonder if they're going to be as one-dimensional, continue to show that sort of one-dimensionality with the running game against Carolina, because I don't think it's going to work nearly to the degree that it worked against Arizona, who doesn't have a great run defense. They have a good defense, but it's mostly because of their pass defense, not their run defense. Carolina, on the other hand, doesn't have a great pass defense, but has a pretty solid run defense. And, of course, you know that with guys like Poe and Short and Kuechly and Thomas Davis. Of course, it's going to be very hard to run the football against them. We saw Coleman have a breakout performance in that Week 2 matchup against Carolina, a team that he has historically struggled against. So, you know, that being said, given the Falcons' inability to run effectively to the right side, as coupled with the fact that Carolina has a stout defense, coupled with the fact that Tevin Coleman is likely to get the bulk of the carries in light of Ito Smith's injury and historically does not fare well against the Panthers, I would not expect the Falcons to have a repeat of their running success this past week against Arizona, next week against Carolina. It could be possible. I've been wrong about things before. The two things over the last 10 years that I've been wrong about, I don't bat 1,000. I just bat 998. I'm kidding. sorry for the tangent. I don't think the Falcons are going to, have a lot of rushing success against Carolina, or at least be able to repeat what they were able to do against Arizona, against Carolina. Going back to Ty Sambrello, I will say at this point, based off of his performance the last couple of weeks where he has not been terrible, as he has typically been throughout his career going back to Denver and, the few opportunities he had last season to fill in for Ryan Schrader for like two games at tackle. He was fine as a tight end later in the season, but he hasn't been that same sort of player. So maybe that means he's turned the corner as a player. And it does take offensive linemen a couple of years to sort of develop. But we'll have to see how he performs the rest of the season. But if he can sort of play the way he's played like the last couple of games, over the next two games, I think he's got Julius Peppers and JPP coming up and whatnot. So it's not as if it's going to be easy in these next couple of games. But I would say if he can sort of maintain the status quo, then I do fully expect him to return back to the team. And if he can maintain the status quo and look serviceable against some of these guys coming up, I'm not going to be completely thrown by his possible return. My expectation is that the Falcons will probably try to sign him to like a 2-year deal or something, pay him a reasonably high salary for a backup offensive tackle, something like $1.5 or $2 million a year or something like that. Ideally, in my opinion, I think the Falcons should probably bring back Ryan Schrader and use a day two in the sort of the round two, round three range on an offensive tackle. I know a lot of people are like, why would you bring back Schrader? He's been terrible this year. And it's like, it's not necessarily because Schrader is this great player. It's because there aren't that many great offensive tackles. Teams don't let good offensive tackles hit the open market. And so there's really only, we talked about this on a recent episode. It's like Trent Brown or bust. And do you really want to drop like $10, $11 million a year on Trent Brown? If he's asking for left tackle money and teams are offering him left tackle money, the Falcons have to pay him left tackle money, as opposed to what they're paying Schrader, who's making good right tackle money. But that's like half of what it's actually less than half, I think, of what actual Jake Matthews is making, who's making top tier left tackle money. But like the problem is after you get past Trent Brown, Juwan James is fine, but like you're not signing Juwan James and being like, oh, this right tackle position is solidified for the next 2 to 3 years. It's like, no, we might get half a season from Juwan James based off of his history, and then you have to be prepared. And while I think Ty Sambrello has been serviceable, him starting 2 to 4 games to me is acceptable, but him starting more than that, I'm going to pump the brakes a little bit on sort of expecting him to be able to maintain this, what he's done, against, particularly against Arizona, for longer than maybe a couple of games here or there. So I think the concern is if you cut Ryan Schrader, are you going to be stuck overpaying for a guy in free agency who's not going to really solve the problem? Or are you going to be stuck being forced to have to draft a rookie really early in the draft, particularly in the top 10 of the first round, where I think a lot of us are sort of like, no, don't take an offensive tackle that high, take a pass rusher, especially in a year where you have a lot of really good pass rushers at the top of the draft and really only one good offensive tackle, if you ask me, based off of what I've seen. Or you're going to be stuck in a situation where you're going to use a day two pick on an offensive tackle, be forced to play that guy early, and probably be stuck with a guy who's not really ready to play like you would expect from a top 10, top 15 offensive tackle pick. And then you're just basically having a net negative, all because you were, you know, too cheap or whatever you want to say to bring back Ryan Schrader. So I think that's really the dilemma the Falcons have, because it's not that Ryan Schrader deserves to come back. It's because the position he plays is really hard to fill. And the fact of the matter is the Falcons, you know, basically dodged a bullet when Ryan Schrader stepped in for Lamar Holmes, because if that didn't happen, who knows what the Falcons would have gotten over the last 4+ years at that right tackle spot. It could have been a major, major issue. And we might have used, I don't know. But anyway, that's really the issue. So, you know, basically, long story short, I don't know if Ty Sambrello is going to help you solve that problem. But at the very least, you know, I wouldn't be totally against bringing him back as a depth guy that can sort of compete for a roster spot. All right, so there's more to come on the show, but I should give a shout-out to the NBA side of the Locked On Podcast Network, where you can find a daily podcast devoted to all 30 NBA teams, including the Locked On Hawks podcast with my good friend Brad Rowland hosting that show. Find that wherever you get your Locked On podcast, your NBA team, every day. So we'll wrap things up talking a little bit about the defense. I thought the Falcons did some interesting things on the defensive side of the ball. They sort of varied their fronts a little bit. They showed some of that bear look, which is sort of their version of the 3-4. They had Irvin sort of playing a little bit of Sam, mostly in that bear look, but sort of asking him to play a little bit more of a, as a Sam rather than being a pure defensive end. I thought he did fine in that role. You saw Steven Means kick inside a couple of times. I think the one, he might even got a sack on the time, one of those times when he was inside. If not a sack, then he certainly got a pressure in one of those instances. You know, we look at the game, reviewing the game, it was very clear that the Cardinals' offensive line was very overmatched in this game. We knew that the Falcons' defensive line was halfway decent, and that they would be able to overmatch the Cardinals, especially once the Falcons got a lead in the first half, and particularly in the second half, where guys were able to be able to pin their ears back and just go after this green, you know, hodgepodge Cardinals offensive line. You know, I like the fact that the Falcons were being aggressive and throwing a lot of blitzes at Josh Rosen, trying to attack this unit that doesn't really have any cohesion whatsoever at this point. You know, I know Marquand Manuel has faced a lot of criticism this season from the fan base, more so seemingly in the last couple of weeks, where basically people, you know, are looking for scapegoats, I think, to a certain extent. I think people are frustrated with the defense's lack of progress. Now, you know me, my whole thing is going to be like, well, that's mostly expectations, because people had absurdly high expectations for this defense this year. I shouldn't say absurdly, but I'm going to say absurdly, because I think any person, any halfway decent analyst should have known that this defense was overrated this year. But I think people, as I often complain about on this podcast, people like to buy into the hype, like to, you know, get excited about a thing, and then they get shocked when that thing doesn't come true. And I've mentioned several times past instances where in 2017 it was the whole Sark is going to be just as good, if not or close to what Shanahan was, because the system hasn't changed and the talent's the same, blah 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 blah, and that caught people by surprise that he didn't come in here and light the world on fire. And people sort of look at this defense this year and be like, oh, they're going to be a top 10 unit, and then they're literally the worst defense in the NFL according to Football Outsiders. I should check to see if maybe they got a slight boost from the fact that they played the Cardinals this past week. No, they did not. Wait, or did this? No, they haven't calculated. Football Outsiders has not updated with this past week's DVOA. So they're still in 32nd. Maybe the gap between them and Oakland is just enough where I think they might be able to move into 31st spot. And so, you know, I know injuries are a big reason why the defensive struggles have been the case. And certainly, as I said on, I think, yesterday's podcast or a recent podcast, where certainly the issues in the first half of the season, you can certainly blame on the injuries. And those injuries, I think, is a valid excuse, in my opinion, for Marquand Manuel. Again, because I did not have these super, super high expectations for this defense. The fact that this defense has fallen apart. You know, we were the 22nd defense in DVOA last year. You take away three out of their top five or six defensive players. It's not a surprise to me that they would fall from 22nd to 32nd, because several of those guys were, you know, Jones and Neal in particular, were sort of the handful of guys that were real difference makers on this defense. So, like, for me, I give Marquand Manuel a pass. I don't feel like he's done a poor job. I certainly get frustrated with some of the three-man rushes. I certainly get frustrated with some of the personnel groupings, you know, looking at certain players that have been struggling this year, getting more reps than I think they deserve. I'm looking at you, Duke Riley. But, like, the three-man rushes, you know, the fact that they ran at, what 10 or 15 times too many, like, why that's not that big a deal. You know, there's no justification for firing a guy for, like, what, 1% of the plays this year. Like, oh, you know, you don't have a problem with 99% of things, but that 1% you got to fire a guy for. That's part of the reason why I always tend to be defending coordinators, with the exception of Sark. But I generally tend to defend coordinators, and I did defend Sark quite a bit last year, because I think people were sort of, most of the criticism towards Sark were nitpicky. And I think that's kind of been the case this year with Marquand Manuel. I think he's done some good things with the defense, not to the degree where I think he should be fired. We'll see if the Falcons sort of reshuffle things, given how poorly the defense has played. And one of the things I've talked about extensively over the last couple of weeks is, given the struggles of the team this year, it kind of sort of could potentially force the team's hand, you know, looking at that guy in the mustache at the top that sits up there up high in the stadium, being like, you know, some heads are going to have to roll. And it's possible in my eyes that Marquand Manuel could be one of those heads. And I've heard the sort of the suggestion that the Falcons either bring in someone new or Dan Quinn takes over play calling on defense next year, and they just sort of adjust Manuel back to being more of a secondary coach, passing game coordinator, whatever it may be. That's, you know, I don't have an opinion on that. If that's what the Falcons do, then that's what they do. I'm not sitting here advocating. Like, I don't sit here and advocate for Dan Quinn how he should run his coaching staff, because, again, one of the things I've said recently on a podcast was 99% of what assistant coaches do outside of the coordinators, you don't ever get to see what they do. So sitting here and judging and being like dictating what Dan Quinn should do with his assistant coaching staff, it's like literally 99.9% of what they do, I have no clue what they do. So to be like, yeah, he should fire that guy, he should change that guy's role or move this guy, like, I have no idea. So I'm not going to talk about things that I have no clue about. I know some of you are snickering, you know, talking about the irony of that. But I try to stay away from those types of things. So we'll have to see if the Falcons can sort of keep this up, or if this is, you know, sitting here right now today, you know, given my pessimism, I'm going to sit here and probably think this is sort of a one-game aberration against a bad Cardinals team that the Falcons needed. But maybe this gives them sort of the confidence to feel like, okay, we're not dead yet. We're still a good team. And maybe they actually come out there and show that in one or both of these final two games of the season and ruin everybody's plans for tanking. Tomorrow we'll be talking, we'll do me a crossover episode with Locked On Panthers host Bill Rossetti. And we'll do a Q&A later in the week. So if you have questions, get those in. Oh, I should also say we're doing a giveaway. I was able to get my hands on some game-worn gloves from everybody's favorite cornerback, Robert Alford, and we'll be giving those away. I'll be putting up something on Twitter. Probably what we'll do is I'll put a post up on Twitter on Monday night. I'll probably pin it to my Twitter page. So you can just go to @FalcFans on Twitter and find it. And if you just retweet it, that's all you need to do to enter the contest. And then I'll just randomly pick one of those retweets at the end of the week. And we'll get that, you know, those gloves shipped your way, you know, just in time, probably a late Christmas gift. I meant to do this last week so that you could possibly get it before Christmas, but you'll just have to, you know, you'll probably get it the week after Christmas or whatever. But yeah, that's the plan right now. So be on the lookout for that. I know, you know, Robert Alford isn't the most popular player among the Falcons, but I know there's a lot of people out there that, you know, should this be the final games of Robert Alford's tenure in Atlanta, you would like a memento to remember him by, particularly given that, you know, contrary to popular opinion, I think Robert Alford has been vastly underrated by a lot of this fan base over the last couple of years, particularly in recent years, where I think he certainly played his two best seasons in 2016 and 2017. I think you can I would make the argument that he was the most consistent and best player on the Falcons defense throughout the 2016 season. I think outside of Keanu Neal and Grady Jarrett, I would make a strong argument that he was the best defensive player on the team in 2017. I know other people like Deion Jones, and I'm like, well, Deion Jones only really played well for like 5 or 6 games. And I think Robert Alford played well for like 12 or 13 games. So, you know, you do the math on that. But that's a conversation for another day. I'm sure I'll hear thoughts on that and whatnot. So there you have it, guys. And until then.
You are Locked On Falcons, your daily podcast on the Atlanta Falcons, part of the Locked On Podcast Network. Your team every day.